New Orleans has been called America's most exotic city, and its French Quarter has long lured tourists with a promise of pleasure and a whiff of the forbidden and the lost. Tour guide Willie Bridges celebrates those qualities on every buggy ride.
On our left is the house of the rising sun. Now, when we say sun, we don't mean S-U-N, we mean S-O-N. When a young man reached the age of 13 and 14, his parents would bring him to this house to make a real man out of him.
Of course, all Gothic tales need a set, and the backdrop for much of New Orleans lore is the French Quarter. As part of the series Present at the Creation, exploring the origins of American icons, NPR's Renee Montaigne visits the heart of New Orleans.
Americans who have never set foot in the French Quarter would recognize a photograph: narrow streets lined with candy-colored houses, French doors and tall shuttered windows opening onto balconies that drip with lacy iron grillwork. This is very much the look that so entranced Mark Twain, who wrote in 1883,
"The houses are massed in blocks. Their chief beauty is the deep, warm, varicolored stain with which time and the weather have enriched the plaster. It harmonizes with all the surroundings and has as natural a look of belonging there as has the flush upon the sunset clouds."
In fact, the French Quarter that Mark Twain wrote about was not much older than Twain himself, and pretty much American-built. The original was far different, with nary a hint of its future romance. Established as the New Orleans in 1718, it was laid out as a grid with a central square in the manner of a French fort, and it was smack dab in the middle of a swamp.
It's not a place that you could build today.
Architectural historian Robert Cangelosi was born and raised in the French Quarter and now designs for a firm that specializes in restoring the quarter. He says federal wetland laws would prohibit it from being built today on land so wet it was nearly impossible to bury the dead.
The bodies used to come out of the ground. You had the flooding of the river being in all the swamps. You had the yellow fever being spread through the mosquitoes. As the port begins to develop, we have epidemics brought in by the rats on the boats. We had bubonic plague. We had cholera. We had all sorts. Almost annual, the city of New Orleans was visited by one plague or another. Then you had the hurricanes.
And then you had the fire. By the late 1700s, when the Spanish took over the Louisiana colony, fire and rain had destroyed nearly all of what was French about the French Quarter. John McGill is curator of the Historic New Orleans Collection.
Right now we're looking at Madame John's legacy. This is one of the oldest surviving buildings in the French Quarter. It dates from about 1788. It has many of the architectural features you would see in French buildings at the time. The wooden gallery, the double-peaked roof. Most of the buildings were still detached. They sat in their own yards. And you would have a lot of open spaces.
All of that changed with the Great Fire of 1794, which consumed the quarter and prompted the Spanish to institute strict fire laws that defined how the new structures would be built. Open space disappeared because the fire laws mandated all buildings be set side by side and pushed to the curb to create a firewall. The French peaked roofs gave way to flat roofs covered with fire-resistant tiles. Wood siding was banned and replaced with fire-resistant stucco, painted in the pastel hues fashionable at the time. By the time the U.S. purchased Louisiana in 1803, the French Quarter was, as it were, halfway to creation, and the Americans finished the job. What had been a touch of Spanish wrought iron, adding elegance here and there, suddenly bloomed all over the quarter. Architect Robert Cangelosi.
Now today everyone comes to the French Quarter and hears about all the Spanish wrought iron. There is very little Spanish wrought iron surviving in the French Quarter today. That is mostly cast iron, primarily made in New York City or in Philadelphia and shipped down here to New Orleans, more so after the Civil War, and put on 1830 federal-style buildings to modernize them in the Italianate taste. You could order it right out of catalogs, applied very easy to buildings, and it was sort of the product of its day. It was sort of like vinyl siding today. If they had vinyl siding back then, the whole quarter would be vinyl sided.
So by the end of the 19th century, the French Quarter had taken on the look that we know today. And there was no single conscious design, no moment of creation, but it could be argued that the French Quarter began at the moment when it nearly ended. That would be just as the 19th century passed into the 20th, and Sicilian immigrants poured into the quarter. For a time, it was known as the Italian Quarter. Cosimo Matassa of Matassa's Market on Dauphine Street was born into a roiling, lively place where his uncles unloaded bananas at the dock to the sounds of Deo, and everyone was poor.
We were living cheek by jowl, all ethnic variations and racial variations. There was a fair amount of Latins. There were lots of blacks. With its community sense, nobody starved. Nobody went hungry. Nobody stayed outside if they didn't have the rent.
To outsiders, though, the French Quarter was a slum. Its slide towards oblivion began long before that of other American city centers, but for the same reasons, fashion, commerce, and money moved elsewhere. Which, says John McGill, is one reason that it still abounds in its famous lacy ironwork.
In other parts of New Orleans, it was being pulled off buildings, but in the French Quarter, it tended to stay, partly because the area had become rather poor at that time, and landlords and owners weren't necessarily willing or even able to afford to pull it off buildings, so it just stayed there, sort of preservation by neglect.
What are now a pair of the French Quarter's most treasured buildings and a favorite of tourists are the exquisite matching Pontalba buildings overlooking Jackson Square. They were built by a baroness in the mid-19th century and, says Robert Cangelosi, gone to seed by the early 20th.
There's a health department report of a full-grown cow on the second floor of the Pontalba buildings during this time frame. My great-grandfather was offered the Pontalba buildings for $10,000. He said, what are you, crazy? What am I going to do with those dump of a buildings? It's too much maintenance in there. The quarter was just slated for demolition.
Among the buildings torn down, General Andrew Jackson's headquarters at the time of the Battle of New Orleans. And there was a plan to raise the building where the Louisiana Purchase transfer took place. All of which brought the citizens of New Orleans to their senses. And then there was the fact that the French Quarter suddenly became interesting. William Faulkner took up residence, followed by Tennessee Williams.
The Renaissance is with the lost generation after World War I discovering the charm of the French Quarter.
Art galleries, theaters, and clubs opened up. And in 1925, the city passed the country's first ever preservation law aimed at saving the French Quarter. Court challenges by developers and squabbling among locals about the quarter's boundaries kept it from going into effect for a decade. But ultimately, says architectural historian Robert Cangelosi, the courts recognized that the French Quarter was a beautiful mongrel of a place and endorsed a legal concept critical to preservation efforts elsewhere, that a neighborhood's whole can be worth far more than its parts.
What we call the tout ensemble, the all-togetherness. It's not one any element that makes the quarter so distinctive. It's not a door or a window or a color or a cast iron pattern. It's the all-togetherness.
Which is why today, close your eyes and you can hear somewhere in the French Quarter at all times the sounds of repair and preservation ringing down its narrow old streets. It is a reminder of the layers of creation that went into making the French Quarter a thing unto itself. I'm Renee Montaigne, NPR News, New Orleans.